Committee on Human Services and Housing, open up the work session on 3301. This bill is not ready for us to move, so we'll hold it over until Monday. I close the work session. 3301, open up the work session on House Bill 20. What is it?
163.
2163.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2163 has a minimal revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It requires the Oregon State Lottery to adopt a comprehensive policy that minimizes the risks and harms associated with lottery games and mandates the director of the Oregon State Lottery to employ a person to advise the Oregon State Lottery Commission on addiction and mental health concerns related to playing lottery games. There is a -4 amendment, Madam Chair.
Yes.
And
so it is a gut and stuff. So I will explain this bill. I've been working with Representative Kennemer, who is here, with Representative Kenny Geyer, and with Representative Julie Parrish. We've worked on this issue for months. And the commission had requested an opinion from the Attorney General's office what it was they could and could not do. So we sat, Representative Kennemer and I sat down with Ledge Counsel one lovely afternoon and went word by word what it was that we could do and what we couldn't do. So the amendment that you have in front of you has been carefully crafted, and I think it does what it need to do. And it does not require anything that the Attorney General's office said that we could not do. So I think I've talked with you, each of you, about this. Any questions? Yes.
This is your bill that you're interested in.
Yes.
This is the, oh yeah, I do remember that one. Yes, I do remember that. That's great.
Good. All right.
Okay.
-4
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move to adopt the -4 amendments dated 4-4-13 to House Bill 2163.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the -4 amendments dated House, dated 4-4-13 to House Bill 2163. Any discussion? Any objection? The amendment is adopted.
Okay, and Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2163 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with prior reference.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2163 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? I just want to say thanks again to Representative Kenner, Representative Kenny Geyer, and Representative Julie Parrish. We worked many, many months on this, and the bill is very different from the way we originally thought it would be, but it's a good bill. It's not perfect. Sometimes the perfect gets in the way of the good, and this is a good bill, so I appreciate your support on this.
Can I say a quick thing?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank you for your leadership and your doggedness in getting us all together and really working through every issue.
Thank you. And again, thank you, Representative Kennemer.
And Debbie.
Okay. Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallego.
He's excused.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Excuse.
Representative
Kenny Geyer. Aye. Representative Whitson. Aye. Representative Whitson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomer.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Olson.
Yes.
And Chair Tomei. Yes. Thank you. And it passes and goes on to Ways and Means. I hope your shoulders better.
Nice work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. With that, we will open at the public hearing on House Bill 3131.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3131 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It requires the superintendent of the Oregon State Hospital to establish and implement a program for continuous employment of healthcare professionals who provide specified services. And if you look in your packets, you will also see a -1 amendment, and I believe there's somebody here to help speak to that.
Great. Thank you. Eva Repito, Mary Lou Sandlis, is that correct? And Daniel Smith. Go ahead, Eva.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Eva Ripito, and I'm representing AFSCME Council 75 and about the 280 nurses that are part of Local 3295, the Oregon State Hospital. House Bill 3131 was an idea of the local president of the nurses local there. When I said, what's one thing that can help you guys with what's going on with staffing needs and everything, he said, we need a permanent float or relief pool, because right now the float pool or relief pool is made up of temporary workers that are limited to 1,029 hours, and which 300 of those hours are spent in training. After those hours, they're let go, and they have to hire new people. And then there are also limited duration people that are limited to 17 months. So if neither of those people are hired into permanent positions, they're let go, and new people are hired, retrained, and then the cycle starts all over again. So we were hoping that this would help cut back on some of the overtime that is needed at the hospital by providing permanent staffing positions that could fill in open shifts. Right now, there are mandated overtime shifts. There are unfilled shifts, especially on weekends. And when this happens, a lot of the clients or the patients that are there don't get to participate in activities because the staff that teaches the classes or the activities also have to be on ward, to cover the minimum number of staffing. So having a relief person that would be able to come in and fill in for those open shifts would allow for activities and classes to continue. And we've also noticed in your packet, I provided a list or a report from February that is incidences of violence and that also mention when they're short-staffed. So, and you'll notice that oftentimes when they're short-staffed are the most often are correlate with violent attacks on other patients and staff. So just as a correlation there. Currently the relief pool is for RNs is at 10 limited duration and 25. As I said, that those are limited to 17 months or 1,029 hours, and 300 of those hours are specific training for psychiatric care. LDs can apply as internal applicants, but temporary workers cannot. So we would like to be able to have them as permanent people so that they can apply for any full-time position as an internal applicant and not run the risk of losing them.
Representative Whitson.
What is an LD?
I'm sorry, limited duration. I apologize.
Okay, could you go back over your testimony and, say it a little slower and
yes.
Say all the words
I'm
out?
I'm sorry. Thanks. I'm terribly Thanks. Nervous. Sorry, Chair Tomei.
That's okay.
Representative Whitson. So limited duration is a temporary employee that's limited to 17 months of employment, and then a temporary worker is limited to 1,029 hours. And that information was acquired off of the applications for those positions. 300 of those hours are spent in training for specific psychiatric care. So if those limited duration employees or temporary employees don't get hired into permanent positions, then we lose them. So the reason why we wanted to make it a permanent position is so that we don't lose these valuable and well-trained people. It's for continuity of care, mostly. I wanted to talk about the dash ones a little bit. When I originally had it drafted, I was not quite sure how to ask for what we needed. So we wanted to get permanent staffing that could be part of the solution to persistent staffing needs, and felt that the original bill was a little bit too vague. And the dash ones defined what nurses saw as a solution without creating specifics that would not lock the hospital into staffing that wasn't helpful. I also should make clear that when we're talking about staffing, we're talking about the frontline workers, like the registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and the MHTs that are oftentimes mandated. And that's what we were trying to get at to help with those staffing solutions. The cost, I'm aware that the state hospital has turned in some fiscal, but I believe that Superintendent, well, I know too, Superintendent Roberts has stated that he's got taken Oregon State Hospital from 30,000 hours of overtime to 20,000 hours in a month. And in my original submitted testimony, I said that was an amount for the year, but it's 20,000 hours of overtime for each month. Having a permanent relief pool to help cover those open shifts would help reduce the costs associated with a lot of the overtime. 20,000 hours of overtime, just to put this into a little bit of perspective, for an entry-level nurse, that's $870,000. And for the highest paid nurse, that's $1.4 million. So if the highest paid nurses, or if everybody was the highest paid nurse and working 20,000 hours of overtime, that would be $1.4 million in a month. That's ridiculous, but I just wanted to kind of give an estimate. So cost is also in continuity of care of the patients. Oregon State Hospital's patients have specialized needs, and there is a huge need for staff that are familiar with those needs. Also, when there are staff shortages, patients aren't able to participate in treatments and activities. These treatments range from classes on their medications, their health, their alcohol and drug addiction. For those who are there for being assessed for aiding in their court cases, there are classes specifically for that. There are also activities like yoga and sports, so physical fitness. And when people can't participate in those because of staff shortages, they get frustrated, and that's when bad incidences happen. So there's a huge cost in injuries and long-term cost to patients who have trouble making improvements because of attacks or threat of attacks, not to mention the treatment costs of the patients and the staff of their physical injuries. So I urge you to adopt the -1 amendments and pass HB 3131, and I'm happy to go into more details that are covered in my written testimony on the staff shortages. But Mary Lou Samblese, might be better suited to answer some of those questions. Thank you again for your
time.
Thank you, Ava.
Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah. Representative Wisdom.
Could we discuss how many nurses you're talking about and how many patients they're caring for and the amount of FTEs that this would increase each position, each... Is it like corrections where it becomes 1.6 FTEs instead of one when you make up that difference for filling in the time? Is it like corrections?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsett, I'm not sure exactly of what those numbers would look like. And I believe that what we wanted to do with the language of the bill was allow for the state hospital to determine what best... How best that would look like. So right now, I don't know, I can't remember the numbers for the mental health technicians. SEIU members could probably best talk to that, about that. But right now, like for the relief pool, it's 10 limited duration registered nurses and 25 temporary registered nurses. So it might be, you know, maybe they hire some as full-time and some as part-time, but I'm unclear what that looks like. Apologize.
Follow up. So could we get some numbers on this? How many nurses, how many patients per nurse or per technician, if you could report back to us, and what the extra would be? Because if we hire these people full-time, we're going to have a benefits package on top of the salary, which is about 60% more than the salary. So we need to understand how many we're looking at and what the cost increase is going to be approximately per patient. And as I understand it now, we're paying about $250,000 per patient at the hospital. And so what we need to see is what is this going to cost per patient? Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Go ahead. Representative Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for your time today, and thank you for the hearing about House Bill 3131. My name is Mary Lou Samblese. I'm a member of ASPA Local and an RN at the State Hospital. We talk about coverage. I've given your assistant chart that covers just the mandated hours. I mean, mandated shifts. These are not hours. These are shifts. So multiply each number by 8 in order to get the number of hours covered. There are some explanations that I want to give. The peak in August, September, and October was when the patients were moving from the old hospital to the new hospital, and we had additional people staying over to get property moved and to get patients safely taken care of. And October was a very high training month, so a lot of people had to be mandated to stay on the units while their coworkers were going to trainings about the new approaches to the hospital. So beginning in November, we get an ordinary sort of looking month. And in the peak of December, January was when we were hiring more nurses. They went through orientation. They hit the floors around March. So you see a drop of mandating, and this is RNs and MHTs. And just for clarification, an MHT, although we call them mental health therapists, they are CNAs.
Which is, could you say what the words are?
Mental health tech, mental health technician.
CNA is?
The CNA is Certified Nursing Assistant.
Thank you. And what kind of education does...
They get about 300 hours of education. They can do it at Chemeketa. They have 1 hour in that process of mental health. They don't have any specialty.
And they don't have a bachelor's degree or a master's?
No. Okay. Some of them have a GED and a CNA.
Okay. Thank you.
So in December and January, we had a lot of people coming through orientation. March, April, May. June, they all hit the floor. They were there. We only had 12 mandated dates. In July, August, the numbers start going up again. That's when we started losing the interim nurses, the short-term, the limited duration. Those people had to come away, and so the people who were left ended up being mandated for more hours.
So I just want to make clear that when you say mandates, that means mandated overtime.
Mandated overtime, meaning you are already at work, you've done your shift, and you can't go home.
Right.
And that's hours?
And that would be like 8 hours, perhaps?
Frequently it is 8 hours. Sometimes it will be less if they can get somebody, let's say, off to come in on their shift 2 hours early, then you're only working 6 overtime.
And wasn't there a change recently on some staff positions, people working like...
13, 20, yes. Yeah, 13 hours and 20 minutes. Those are only weekend positions.
Just in the weekend, okay.
And that was to help us close the weekend gap.
Okay.
When one of those people calls in sick, we usually have to have two people to cover that hole because we can't work anybody more than 16 hours.
Right, so you can't mandate.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So we frequently have to shuffle staff. I was in the staffing office this morning and found out that we are short-staffed on a daily basis. We have a total of 933 RN positions, but that includes all nurse managers and nursing supervisors. They say that on a daily basis, we are down 30% in our staffing needs due to FEMLA, OFLA.
We're not going to use letters.
Okay, family medical leave.
Okay.
Where people say, you know, I can't come in, my wife is sick or my child is sick, and this is a pre-approved shortage, but it does have to be covered. And then vacation times as well as just sick calls. The people that are mandated, that are told you cannot go home, may have as many as 4 hours warning or as little as half an hour. They may tell them at 4 o'clock in the morning, we're down 7 people for day shift. You're on the mandate list because it's taken in rotation. So you're next on the list.
Right.
If I can't get anybody to do it voluntarily, if I can't find anybody who is willing to come in early, you're going to be mandated.
So when you work overtime, do you get time and a half?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
And for that reason, there are a lot of people who do voluntarily cover.
Representative Gelser.
And just so that I can understand this concept, and it kind of goes back to the question that Representative Woods had asked before about the relative cost. We're not talking about increasing the hours of coverage at the hospital. We're talking about changing the way that we fill those hours. So if we had this, those same hours would be filled by a person being paid at a regular rate
straight
who
time
was
rather.
Rested, as opposed to someone in their 15th hour being paid time and a half.
Exactly.
So I have a question. So did you say at any given time we are paying for 30% of the people to be absent?
That's the number that I got.
We're actually paying, because we have 40 different types of paid leave in the state. So at any given time, we're paying for 30% of the people to be absent. So that's essentially what your issue is that we're paying for the absentee, but there's not enough people to cover because 30% of the people are chronically absent on paid leave, right?
Well, not all of them are on paid leave. Some of them, yes, they'll be using their own sick time or vacation or whatever. But some people on family medical leave have run out of paid time, but their kid is still sick, still got leukemia, and they've got to go to OHSU. So they're going to be gone for 6 hours, or they'll be gone for that shift. They're not paid, but we still have to have time and a half somebody to cover them.
So could we find out how much is paid time and how much is not paid time?
I certainly will
okay,
ask them
you.
To do that.
Yeah.
Representative Kennedy.
I think she answered it. Thank you. I was just going to say the OFLA and the FEMLA, the Oregon Family Leave Act and Federal Family Leave Act, would be unpaid time.
Frequently.
But that's a good question. How much of it is the paid sick and vacation time versus how much it is the unpaid leave under the Family Leave Act?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
And I want to make sure that it's okay to ask questions at this
point. Of course.
So moving away from the financial aspect of this, one of the things that I'm struck by is the stressful nature of the environment at the state hospital for both the workers and the patients that are there. And I'm wondering about the impact on the climate when you have a person that has been working in a very stressful, very engaged environment in their 14th or 15th hour. Can you talk about how that impacts the safety of both patients and staff?
Certainly, having been there for the 15th and 16th hours. After about the 12th hour, you're really not very smart. I've been doing this kind of job my whole life, and I will still miss things just because I'm too weary to pay attention to it. People who don't have as much experience as I have or aren't as tuned to folks may miss something and let a crisis occur that might have been prevented had we had staff that were on top of it. Emotionally, when you demand that someone stays at work, if they're not prepared for that, I mean, the difference between a voluntary overtime and a mandated overtime is I've got childcare to take care of. If I know I'm going to be working Wednesday night, I'll have that arranged. If I'm working Wednesday day shift and don't know that I have to stay, then I don't have any way to pick up my kid to take care of this, that, or the other thing, and it's very disruptive. So you get people who are generally unhappy and irritated just by having to be there. And then they're surrounded by patients who also don't want to be there, so that's sometimes a very bad mix. When you're talking about staff to patient ratio, in Harbors, which is the admission area, we generally want what they call 774. That's seven floor staff. One of those usually is an RN to 26 patients. 774, seven on day shift, seven on afternoon shift, four on night shift. That's at a minimum. That is the absolute minimum safe limit. If you have, on the weekend, seven staff, or as one of the units did last weekend, and I'll just use this as an example, it was one of the flowers units, which are patients who are further along in their treatment. They're not as acute. They've adjusted and usually medicated nicely, and they're just spending time there. There were three staff. There was one RN and two CNAs and 27 patients. Two of them had visitors. And because two patients had to leave the unit, if each of them had taken a staff member with them, which is what the standard is supposed to be, that would have left one person alone on the unit with 25 patients, which is not acceptable. So those people had to wait, and their visitors had to wait until they could shift folks around and send somebody over just to walk people to the visiting area. It impacts not only the staff, but the patients on a daily basis. There are not only just activities that don't happen. You know, your mom has come from Jefferson County or Coos Bay, and you can't see her, and she sits and waits because there's nobody to bring you the 100 yards to the visiting area.
Go, sir.
Thank you. Eva sent this morning long lists, and I've actually read them today and had a lot of questions about them, but one of the things that I noticed was that impact of the short staffing on the safety of the entire unit when a plan that is expected to happen doesn't take place. Mm-hmm. So within these kind of narratives that came from Eva this morning, descriptions of people finding out they're not going to be able to see their parent as mm-hmm. expected, or I can't go to the TV room as I expected. And when you have individuals whose freedoms are already pretty significantly restricted, not going to the TV room is a pretty big deal that, you know, in some of these cases escalated to the place where people are restrained on a striker board and end up with arm restraints and end up in locked seclusion for hours at a time.
Exactly.
Which I don't know is what anybody would want to see happen. I think that the other question that I had reading through this, and I hope we can maybe have the superintendent come at some time, you know, I read through these a couple of times and tried to think about them through a variety of perspectives. And the frequency of the use of seclusion and restraint and the range of the types of situations that led to that, some where there very clearly was physical violence and imminent risk of serious physical injury. In other places, it seemed like it was difficult, challenging, frustrating behavior, mm-hmm. not enough staff, not enough time to deal with that person, so the person goes into locked seclusion so people can move forward, probably not entirely consistent with what the policy is.
Exactly.
So I would be really interested in hearing from the superintendent how the hospital both responds to the responsibility of the staff and keeping staff safe in these points. And if I think about that, in the 15th hour, someone spitting in my face and calling me words that I don't say out loud, and all of these things are happening around me, and I'm a patient, and my whole day has been turned upside down because there isn't enough time to do things, and so people are getting hurt and getting locked away, that's a lot of people being hurt. And I would like to hear from the superintendent how they are following up on seclusion and restraint and looking at how these rates of seclusion and restraint are increased by inadequate staffing, by really tired people, and is it fair to hold staff accountable for inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint when there really are no other options available to them because there is nobody else that is there and they haven't slept in a really long time. So this was really helpful. It was really troubling reading for me, and I want to be clear, I'm concerned about some of the use of seclusion and restraint in here, but I think that it is very directly related to staffing. I think it's directly related to training, and I think the superintendent should be able to talk to us about why that's acceptable and why we're not hearing more from the administration of the state hospital proactively saying, we have a problem, our staff and our patients aren't safe, and I want to see the state hospital administration here telling us that we need to do this and adequately staff them.
Thank you, Representative. We'll do that.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Representative Whitson.
Since a lot of us don't have background in this, could you explain, like, how the state hospital is set up, how many patients there are, and then Are they in groups of 27? You mentioned 27. Or how? What are we looking at? Because to me, it looks like a big building, and I don't know who's there and who's taking care of whom.
So. Oh, that's fair. There are three programs. There's Harbors, and that's the admission, high acuity, maximum security area. And then there's Trails, which is sort of the step-down area, people that possibly have not satisfactorily learned legal skills, or they're still unable to cooperate with their attorney, but they're no longer in need of acute services, can go to Trails, continue with their 370 training. And then there's Bridges, which is the stepping out. That includes the cottages. It includes several of the other things. And I think it also includes the geriatric units. Is that right? I think, aren't they part of Bridges?
Before we follow up with him, do you have any more that you want to say to us?
Well, I do want to say that if we had a core group of people that we could count on to be available when we needed them, the patient services would be much improved. And that's, as a psych nurse, that's my concern. We're not taking good care of the patients when our staff is overworked, when our staff is irritated, or just exhausted, physically exhausted. We had a situation a couple weeks ago where a guy was bitten very seriously on the face. He went to work the next day and got mandated. So, you know, we're trying our best, but there are holes that we need to have plugged. I thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And I will answer any questions that I can.
Wait, we'll wait and see if anybody after this gentleman speaks up.
Any questions?
Representative
Kenny Garr.
I had one.
Kenny
Garr.
No, I thought you said I had a question.
Oh, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're a very special profession, very difficult profession. I know, like firefighters, yes, there's in that career field, some of they want so much overtime, but you keep describing a relief pool. Why wouldn't you want to just increase your FTEs, full-time equivalent positions, and not, you know, because if you're looking at the big picture, trying to balance overtime pay, which is time and half, by just increasing the staff, is that the union, or we talked about that?
Can you go ahead?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett. I believe that when I was talking with the union members about this, and specifically their local president, who couldn't be here today because he's working overtime, he understood that asking for more staff was a bigger financial lift than asking for a permanent relief pool, and that it was a small step in a right direction, and that it's not the end-all be-all solution, but a way to help make ends meet in a tough financial time.
Well, I guess, Madam Chair,
yes,
a question needs to be posed on that then. Why is he not here?
He's mandated to
work.
Overtime.
The superintendent?
Superintendent.
Oh. Sorry, Chair Tomei and Representative Olson, I don't know why the superintendent is not here. However, Frank, the local president, had to work overtime today.
Thanks. Okay. And I don't know why the superintendent isn't here.
Can we invite the superintendent to come?
Absolutely, we
Thank
will.
You. Okay.
And I would just like to clarify, we have the positions funded that are good for 17 months. And we're just saying, basically take the limit off so we can keep them. They've been hired, they're now experienced, and because it is limited duration, we have to let them go.
But Madam Chair, Madam.
Yes.
You know, again, I go back to my question. I know from some of my work in Backpack that, you know, as you described, at a certain point, it makes more sense to have more FTEs than have this pool of 17 months or whatever, but not only for cost, but for morale and for the work you described and conditions. So this committee's, I guess that's going to happen in ways and means to look at that. But I just sort of had maybe should have preferred you'd say, well, oh, we need this many FTEs and let them evaluate, because it could be better financially, it could be better for your morale and your health than to say keep this relief pool, which you're saying is only good for 17 more months. Mm-hmm. And that's, I won't say anymore. It's Friday afternoon.
Okay. Chair Tremaine, Representative Wilson. I think in other hospital situations, they do have float pools where they are FTE positions that don't have an assigned unit that they go, but they float to cover any absences. And we weren't sure if that would be the right solution for the state hospital, but we're wanted to have something that would give them flexibility to assign people where they needed when there were open shifts that needed to be covered.
Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, respected members of the committee. I'm Dr. Daniel Smith. I am a forensic psychologist at the Oregon State Hospital. I'm here on behalf of SEIU. I'm a proud SEIU member, and I'm also an elected representative for Local 392 at the Oregon State Hospital. We are very much in favor of House Bill 3131, amend with dash one. However, we would like you to also consider allowing permanent part-time positions to be included here as well. I'm going to try and touch upon some of the questions that I've heard asked. The representative asked earlier if this was the 1.6 FTE like in the prisons. Actually, this is more like the 0.6 itself. The hospital has had struggles in having appropriate posting factors. We are currently having of the, and forgive me, these are rough numbers. There are about 500 members of our nursing staff, which includes the RNs, the LPNs, and the vast majority of the mental health therapy technicians, the MHTs we refer to, who have Family Medical Leave Act, either the federal or the Oregon Family Medical Leave Act, either because of injuries that they've received at work or because of issues within their family. Many of these people are unable to work because of family issues or because of their own health issues, and they may miss at intermittent periods of time. They cannot be regularly scheduled very often. When it is, we know that the staffing office will work with us and the administration to fill those positions. But when it's irregular, having a relief pool allows someone to be assigned to a particular unit for a particular shift and then to be sent to a different unit or a different shift on the next day. These are staff who are hired essentially as relief in a permanent way, that they continue to float throughout the hospital. They're not assigned to a specific position. Allowing the hiring of permanent part-time would allow us to hire students from the area, from Willamette University, from potentially Oregon State and University of Oregon, from the other colleges in the area who could work part-time, working weekend and evening shifts that are not as desirable to most full-time employees, supplementing their incomes, paying for their schooling and so on, and also providing us with people who are eager to learn. Very often in other hospital situations, we have seen where psychology students and social work students apply for exactly these kinds of jobs so that they can get some experience working with the population of mentally ill that we work with. Going on beyond that, our staff work very hard to meet the needs of our patients, and I am unaware of the information that was given to you about people being put into seclusion and restraint because there's a need to move people. I'm totally unaware of that. I've never heard of anything like that happening. That our staff work very hard to prevent putting people into seclusion or into restraint, and that only occurs when violence is imminent or violence has occurred. I am unaware of that ever happening for any other reason. We do occasionally have problems moving people, getting patients to a visiting area, getting them to appointments, and so on. However, the hospital has a very large staff of mental health security techs who are well-trained and who actually do that. That's their primary function of moving groups of people from one place to another. This is a part of how the current administration of the hospital is working to address problems in ways that were not addressed previously. Right now, we have a relief pool of about 56 people. We are allotted, I believe, 75 or 77 people for that. They have been unable to find enough people to keep that pool full. The primary reason there is because many of the people who come into the relief pool now, upon finding a full-time position available in the hospital, apply for it, leave the relief pool, and then their life becomes more steady. They have a full-time position where they're guaranteed, I'm going to go to this unit on this day and this time I'm going to have this schedule. A permanent relief pool would allow us to hire people into permanent positions and train them appropriately so that they could continue to serve that relief, and allow us to seek out people, such as students and so on, who are looking to supplement their income. We believe that this would potentially widen the pool of people who would apply for positions at the hospital. My own experience at the Wisconsin State Hospital speaks to this, in that I was a student there and began training at the hospital in a relief pool position. I'm more than happy to answer any questions that I can, or to try to clarify anything that I haven't made clear. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Gelser.
Yes, I wanted to make a clarification. There's nothing in here that says somebody was put someplace for convenience or less than an emergency. That was my reading of, there was a range, there were some things that didn't seem to rise to the level of the policy, and by rereading them, I was thinking about the circumstances that might change judgment in terms of moving things and the choices that are made about individuals. But Eva did not provide me anything that said people are being put in seclusion and restraint because there is a lack of staffing or for convenience.
Thank you, Representative. I apologize for my misunderstanding.
You know, I apologize for not communicating it well. That's wholly my fault.
If there's nothing, Representative Comberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I get what we're talking about here. One of the consequences of tight budgeting is finding creative ways to find enough people to get the jobs done. And so what you're suggesting is a permanent relief pool is going to provide us with experienced people rather than retraining people every time their limited period of availability expires. So my question, and this may be outside your area of expertise, is we have a unique situation at the state hospital. Are you foreseeing other agencies or areas where a permanent relief pool may also be applicable?
Absolutely.
Representative Tomei, Representative Gomberg, in the normal course of events, it is unlikely that this kind of relief pool would be useful in other settings. However, and I say this only partially tongue-in-cheek, the understaffing that's currently occurring within DHS and OHA for child case management might be a case for a large relief pool there, though I think there are other remedies that would be more appropriate in that setting.
I see that Leah Kraft is here from OHA. Leah, would you come up, please?
Chair Tomei, I found the numbers in my notes for Representative Witsit's question about cost. It's $21,000 per month for per patient at the state hospital. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
How many patients are there? How many patients are there?
If I may, Representative. Tomei and Representative Whitsitt. There are 22 units of 25 patients each, which would mean 550 patients at the hospital with a full allotment. We are a little bit below that currently, as there are some units that have remained closed because of budgetary requirements. However, with the coming closure of the Blue Mountain Recovery Center and the Portland, Oregon State Hospital, we'll see that number reach maximum very quickly with all units full.
Thank you very much for coming and sharing your information with us. And we will have another hearing to get more information. Leah, thank you so much for coming today.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Leah Kraft. I'm the Government Affairs Manager for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Oregon Health Authority, which includes the State Hospital. And I will be very brief. We've had conversations with AFSCME about this bill. I've spoken with the superintendent about this bill as well. We completely agree that there is a staffing issue. We have overtime issues. We have for a number of years. We also have a budget issue, and there are vacancies at the hospital as well. But we would be more than happy to come back and talk about the staffing issues. And we would also like to offer this committee a tour of the hospital, should that fit into your schedule as well, and also address the seclusion and restraint topic that Representative Gelser brought up.
Great. We will certainly do that. Okay. Any further questions? Representative Gelser.
Yes. So I think a group tour of the state hospital is always great. I think what was most helpful to me was a tour that AFSCME arranged for me, where I was able to spend a day, and except for the person that had me there, neither the staff or the patients knew that I wasn't a staff person. Is that something that could be arranged for each of us? I think it certainly gave me a different perspective than any of the other kind of more official tours I've had the opportunity to be part of in the past.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, we definitely would be in support of those tours. I know that's something that AFSCME is probably more than happy to do, and we would be accommodating in any way that we could.
And it's just fascinating to take the time to do that, either of the tours, either sort of the official one or the one with AFSCME. It's fascinating. Representative Whitson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know you heard my comment, but so I would think that you and the superintendent would want to have a recommendation on this, and I would hope that that recommendation would look at this floating pool and whether that's done at other institutions similar and things like that. And would you also answer, I didn't get all the numbers and things, but is the staffing of the state hospital under 2020, House Bill 2020, are you trying to get to the 1 to 14? And are those supervisors allowed to backfill? Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, that's a very good question. The 1 to 20 ratio has been a bit of a challenge.
14 and 1 to 14.
Oh, yeah, I apologize. At the hospital, we do fit that in. It comes under the entire OHA ratio that we look at, but I'd be happy to provide that information on where we're at with that, but just at the hospital.
Yes.
And will the superintendent make a recommendation on this plan versus something else, or is he like, or he's going to?
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, we are neutral on this bill, but if the committee is asking for a recommendation, we would definitely be more than willing to look into if this would be what we would recommend.
The chair is prerogative.
Thank you, committee. We've been working on this issue over 12 years that I've been in the legislature. It's very, very difficult. It's better than it was. It's still extremely difficult. Thank you, Leah. Thank you, committee. Thanks for those of you who came to testify. Thanks for the work you do. You're terrific. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3131 and open up the House Bill 3112.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3112 has a revenue statement that was issued, and it may have a fiscal impact. Statement has not yet been issued. on a dash 2 amendment. One thing you'll find in your packets are a dash 1 amendment and also a dash 2. What the measure does is it exempts from the property taxation property of political subdivision used or intended to be used for affordable housing or leased or rented to persons of lower income for housing. It requires application and is effective on the 91st day following the adjournment of sine die.
Thank you very much. And we have a list of people.
We do.
Okay. Lindsay,
Kendra.
Thank you. And Andy Smith, Aaron Doyle. Great. Give us your name and you can start testifying.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. Before I get started on testimony, I just wanted to let you know that we have expert city staff in the audience in case questions come up, so they're at your disposal, and along with Lindsay's expertise, we should be able to get through any questions you might have. House Bill 3112 clarifies that city-owned property that is used for affordable housing is tax-exempt. The Fairfield apartments are the subject of House Bill 3112. They were built in the early 1980s by the Fairfield Group, and shortly after completing the building, the Fairfield Group entered into a long-term contract with the local housing authority to limit all units in the building to Section 8 tenants. The City of Portland acquired the Fairfield in 2001 when the Fairfield Group moved to terminate its Section 8 contract. Between 2001 and 2009, the Fairfield was exempt from taxation, but in 2009, the county assessor changed his mind and decided to treat the property as not tax exempt. Litigation ensued over the very technical issue of whether a couple ambiguous statutes meant that municipal real property used for affordable housing is tax exempt. The city and the county both agree that the Fairfield should be tax exempt. We're both serving the same people who live at the Fairfield, and we both have an interest in ensuring that local governments have the tools they need to preserve affordable housing. Rather than continue to litigate the issue, Portland and Multnomah County settled the legal case and are jointly pursuing clarification of the statute. House Bill 3112 clarifies that city-owned property that is used for affordable housing is tax-exempt, just like if it was owned by a nonprofit or a housing authority. The dash 1 or dash 2 amendment now represents further refinement of the bill by the city and the county. It clarifies that the burden is on the real property owner, the city in this case, to certify annually that the use of the property meets the requirements of the exemption. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lindsay.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and the committee. My name is Lindsay Kandra. I am from the Multnomah County Attorney's Office. My specialty is tax law, and I hope that we don't fall asleep during tax law because I know how property taxation isn't the most exciting topic to talk about.
It actually is.
I think so, too, but I usually get the kind of cross-eyed look when I say that. I'm just here to talk about the Dash 1 amendments that we recommended to this bill. The first Dash 1 amendment that I want to talk about, the change on page 2 deleted the language.
So I'm going to stop you for a minute. So are we looking at just the Dash 2 or the Dash 1 and the Dash 2?
Chair Tomei, I think that the Dash 2 was kind of hot off the press, and it basically made a very technical change to the Dash 1s, but the Dash 1s are incorporated in the Dash 2s.
Okay, so why don't we just talk about the Dash 2s then, right?
Change your line references.
Okay. I didn't know there was a Dash 2, so, but it's going to be the exact same comments here. There's a change on page 2 of this bill that deletes the language intended to be used. The original phrase was held or intended to be used. This change was requested to ensure that the property that is being requested to be exempt from property taxation is in fact being used for an exempt purpose at the time the application is received by the county. The second Dash 2 amendment has to do with an insertion after line 36. We requested this change because ORS 307.110, which is the bill that's being amended here, the statute that's being amended here, contains a category of exemptions that the county assessors approve and administer. Low-income housing has never been one of those types of properties. Those types of properties basically come to us having already met a set of requirements, either as housing authorities or as properties owned by nonprofit corporations. When we read the initial bill, we were concerned that it was going to be that the county assessor's office was going to be charged with the responsibility of periodically confirming that property was being occupied by low-income individuals and the rents were at below market. This has never been our responsibility, and we do not have the resources or the expertise to monitor that those properties are in fact being used as low-income housing. The insertion after line 36 is intended to place the responsibility on the owner, in this case the city, to certify that the property is indeed being used for low-income housing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. The dash 2 is our tweak. Technical tweak. We support the underlying bill, and we just wanted to clarify the use of the word political subdivision. It's a very technical lawyer-on-lawyer argument, but in this, the dash 2, that first part, replaces the term political subdivision throughout Section H and replaces it with the same list of entities that's included in Section 1 of ORS, 307.110. So it's just a technical amendment that we wanted for clarification to ensure that cities, as listed in Section 1, are still listed in Section H.
Thank you very much. Any question of anyone on the panel?
I do have a question. You were speaking about this as related to Portland specifically, but the bill doesn't specifically say Portland, so would this be throughout the state of Oregon then?
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt. So if any local government or whatever, however the local body meets the definition in the statute, if they were to own real property and they were to use it for a purpose that meets the exemption, so affordable housing, let's say, then it could apply anywhere. We don't know of anywhere else in the state where this is true. For us, it's the Fairfield, and then we have another building that is exempt under an agreement with Multnomah County outside of the statute, which it would probably apply to that building as well. But those are the only two buildings that we know of, and
that normal.
That's the only. Those are the only buildings that the county assessor knows as well.
I have a question. Would it make more sense then to make this specific to what your issue is, rather than spread it out over the state, since it only is applicable to one or two situations in the state? I mean, I'm just trying to understand, you know, sometimes there are unintended consequences from making something that, you know, is applicable everywhere when it really, you want it a fix for one thing.
Chair Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, I believe it's important to keep this at a statewide level. It is very rare circumstances in which this will arise, but the purposes of the exemption is to encourage lower income housing and that sort of mechanism. So I think that it doesn't need to be directed just at Portland, because essentially we're exempting ourselves from paying property taxes to ourselves as cities. So it'd be the city would have to pay the city and the county. So it's just it's a way. I think it's an important fix to maintain it statewide.
Follow up.
Would this include drug and alcohol rehabilitation, real properties throughout the state then, if they are essentially city owned? Or county-owned or nonprofits. I mean, I can just sort of see this opening up potentially a very large or foster homes that may be owned by the state or the cities. Or I'm just trying to understand what this might include.
I've got a two-part answer for you, Representative Whitsitt, Commissioner Tomei. This particular bill addresses low-income housing, which is a term that has a very specific definition under the taxation statutes. The types of organizations that you're referring to in the second part of your question, many of those are already exempt from property taxation under different statutes in the Oregon tax code. This one only addresses low-income housing, and if you track that phrase through different statutes, it's a very specific type of housing limited to certain individuals with certain income levels, market rents, paying rents that are a certain level below market. So it seems bigger. Mm-hmm. But if you track it through the definitions, our bill is intended to address a very specific set of properties.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
It did. Okay. And then I'm thinking, what if by rule we change the definition of low-income housing
authorities,
which happens sometimes. We, by rule, we change things, and so I'm just wondering, you know, can it be expanded by the Oregon Health Authority or Department of Human Services under the Housing Division that Margaret Van Vliet is in charge of now, because she's got a lot of low-income public housing. We're talking about building more, and so I'm just sort of not clear on this exactly what is and what isn't, because they talk about low-income housing and lots of it here in the state. And you're saying there's only two places that qualify for that, but that, I think the term must be being used differently than the legal term. But what I'm saying, are we going to change it so low-income housing means low-income housing everywhere, not just according to your definition, the tax definition of it? I'm probably clear as mud, but we hear the term low-income housing a lot in this committee, and so I'm trying to understand exactly if it can be enlarged, and then are all those places exempt from taxation?
Representative Whitsitt, Chair Tomei, that's a question that I really can't answer. Low-income housing under the tax statutes is a term of art, and that's what this bill is intended to address, is the term of art under the tax statutes, which is there's an income level, and there is a market rent level. Whether those can be changed is up to you all, and the assessor, we just do what you all tell us to do. So
it's
a hard question for me to ask. It would depend on what you give us right. to work with in the
statute.
And
it was rhetorical. I mean, excuse me, but I'm just thinking we use the term a lot, mm-hmm. and I don't know if the term we use is the legal term. Or
Madam Chair.
I have Representative Gelsinger,
I'm sorry.
And I'll get to you.
No, I think it's an important question because we always want to make sure that what happens in a rule doesn't change what we've done in the law. But I think in this case where we're talking about low-income housing or the phrase affordable housing, we have so many federal dollars and grants that are dependent on the working definition that we have of affordable housing or low-income housing that to get to any point where we were going to change that, that's not something that's going to happen in a secret meeting or without an enormous amount of thought, just because there will be so much at risk that we would lose. So in this case, I appreciate the question, and I think we should always ask that, but I don't think we have to worry very much in this case just because of how many programs depend on our working definition of those programs right now.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm confused. We have a letter that the committee members have provided. I don't know if you got it from Revenue. And that's why I'm having so much difficulty here, because they give us an example of what you're asking for here they talk about Cafe Today is taxable, but like your office would be in a building and you wouldn't be taxable too. Is that not what the bill's about? And also, Madam Chair, thank you for LOC saying you support it. How about AOC? AOC has a taxing function too, and if we're not going to move this today, maybe it'd be nice to have some sort of idea of what the counties or cities anticipate loss in revenue would be from this bill. Thank you.
Should be in your packet today. In today's packet.
This one?
I'm sorry, I was sure. Looking at all of it.
It's like this. I see some woman in the back who's going like this. Would you like to speak to some of this? It's you, Ms. Madam, with the wonderful dark hair.
Daniela.
I didn't mean to embarrass you, but obviously you know a lot, and I'm inviting you to speak if you would care to.
Chair Tomei, Representative Witz, so we haven't seen the letter from Revenue, and I think what they're, I'm not sure what they're referring to in there, but I am sure that it's not, it doesn't appear to be the subject of the bill. I mean, the bill is simply clarifying that if a city were to own a building, which we only know of two cases where that happened, and one is tax exempt already by agreement between the city and the county, that if a city owned a building or a county and they used it for a purpose that met the affordable housing exemption requirements, that it would also be tax exempt. So I know that the legal case was a little bit more confusing, and perhaps they were talking about some of the really technical reasons that the tax court used with, you know, if a tenant owned property, then therefore, and it was leased to the tenant, and they could, their property was taxable, then the building would be taxable, and that was sort of the details of the lawsuit. But you know, I think that the statute ORS 307090 already says that municipal owned property that's used for a municipal purpose is tax exempt, and that's what the cities were operating under that premise from the beginning with this particular building and all the other properties that meet that purpose. So there was a dispute that came about, and what we're trying to do is just iron that dispute out for this one particular building to clarify that the property is not shouldn't be tax exempt because they're meeting the exemptions of the requirement and providing an important public service to the community.
Did you wish to speak?
Hi, my name is Daniela Desmond. I'm with the Portland Housing Bureau. I just wanted to clarify that what, in terms of a policy level discussion, what this bill does for the Housing Bureau is it really clarifies some obscurity around who are the owners and operators, typical owners and operators around of affordable housing or low-income housing. Like Andy said, it's very rare examples where the city would want to hold or own or operate affordable housing. Typically, it's housing authorities and nonprofits. So to Representative Witsit's point around, you know, sort of, you know, would this apply further? It really, you know, it's very rare instances that the city came into possession of this building and bought this building, either for, you know, the purposes of trying to preserve affordable housing and keeping those homes and the folks that live in those homes stable, or in the case of maybe something like a foreclosure or a nonprofit or a housing authority that might come into trouble, we would try to help stabilize the building to protect the tenants that are there. So all this does is really clarify, in our minds, what this does is it clarifies our ability to be tax exempt in that that situation. So
I get that. I guess I'm still thinking that Representative really hasn't had her question answered yet. I think what she's asking, if I'm correct, Representative Witsit, is can this have unintended consequences of covering many more properties than this one property that is being discussed? Right. And if it's meant just for one property, why didn't it say just for this one property? Is that, am I correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I'm just looking at the revenue impact. It says parentheses in the millions of dollars. Now, if it's one building, I don't understand why the revenue impact is in the millions of dollars.
Chair Tomei, Representative Witsa, we haven't seen the letter from Revenue. I'm not sure if
it's a different one.
Complete it. There's no language out beside it. It looks like that's just a heading.
That's the heading.
Yeah. Okay. So we don't know what the fiscal is on this yet. But it doesn't mean it's in the millions. It just says in millions of dollars.
Right. If there were an impact, it would be in the millions. Does that make sense? That's how Ledge Fiscal, that's their heading that they use.
Okay, I just hadn't seen that before. Okay.
But it seems like we have some questions that maybe we could have answered next week. Any other questions that you'd like for this panel? So you understand what the questions are, right? And so if you could give us an answer, I think perhaps we can move on this bill.
Thank you.
Anything else you need to say to us that you want us to hear before we go away for the weekend?
Don't want to stop that.
All right, good. I like to hear that. Thank you so much. With that, we will close the hearing on House Bill 3112, and I think that's all the business for today. Have a great weekend. Close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.